Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. It's a little bit overcast here in Atlanta, Georgia, but we are feeling shiny as a set of new pennies. I got some new clothes on. My name's Ben.
Ben, my name is Noel. A set of new pennies?
Yeah, because there are three of us. I was going to say a couple, and I was like, oh, Casey is also a shiny penny all his own. Super producer Casey Pegram.
He's definitely shiny, and he's shining up the room here because we're once again in the odd studio where we sit all together face to face, as opposed to us inside the shipping container and him on the outside of the glass looking in.
And you're Noel.
That is me. Did I not say that? Gosh, you're probably right, Ben. I didn't say that. Hey, since we're all in here together, you guys want to wrestle?
Let's do it.
I will morally support you.
Okay. Well,
yeah, I'm a little under the weather, so I don't want to risk putting you any more at risk than you already are.
Well, to be fair, Ben, that kind of gives you the advantage. You could just pin us to the ground and then cough in our faces, and that would just like weaken us further. You know,
I'm sure that's something that some people are very interested in seeing.
Yeah.
Well, not them.
They won't be able to see it, but they could at least hear it. But theater of the mind.
Theater of the dirty mind. Mm-hmm. I want to add that another neat thing about the studio we're in now is that we are surrounded by fan art made by Aaron Cooper, also known as Coop, wherein he's taken our pals Josh and Chuck and a couple times, let's see, Jonathan Strickland, aka the Quister, and myself, actually, and he's put us in these weird movie posters.
Scenarios?
Yes, there we go. Yes, just like the Quister would say, you can also see, you can see some of his weird fan art if you want to check it out.
And one of these is a tribute to the late, great Terry Jones. Was really sad to hear of his passing. Monty Python legend, director of my favorite Monty Python film, The Holy Grail, of course. And that's one of the ones on the wall there, is Chuck as King Arthur. Josh, as I believe, Sir.
Is that Galahad?
Galahad, I believe. And then we've got.
There's Jonathan in the back.
And that's you, right?
Yeah, that's me. You know what? We'll just take a picture of this and we'll post it on our favorite Facebook site, Ridiculous Historians.
But then it wouldn't be theater of the mind.
I know. But then maybe they wouldn't be hearing it while they're looking at the picture.
That's a good point.
So now it's theater of the eye.
I like that. But the reason I bring up the wrestling is because I've got this personal moral code where I will not allow anyone to take my fair tiny hand in marriage unless they can best me in a wrestling match. And it was weird because I've had this all my adult life.
But you thought it was an original thing.
I thought,
right?
It was an original thought. Yeah. I thought that was just, you know, I've got this code, Noel, you're going to stick to it. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out, you know, we were researching this episode on the great, great granddaughter of one Genghis Khan. You may know him as Genghis Khan, but you may know him wrong, my friends, for it is Genghis, like Jenga. And his great, great granddaughter was named Khatun?
Khatun?
Let's 4-0 it real quick.
Khatun.
I was pretty close.
If we smashed both of our pronunciations together, we would end up with the right one.
Because it feels like it should be three syllables, but it's the way we're pronouncing it is two. We don't speak Mongolian. Please be kind. But we're going to go with Khatun,
yes,
for now.
I think that's smart. Also known as Shining Moon.
That's right. She was the great great granddaughter of Genghis Khan, as you said, and she was believed to have been born around 1260 to Kaidu. Kaidu was a grandson of Ogdai Khan and a cousin of Kublai Khan. Unlike Kublai Khan, the guy who founded the Yuan dynasty and assimilated to Chinese culture, Kaidu said, "We're going to stay true to our roots. We started this game as nomads. We're going out as nomads. We're keeping that lifestyle." And this worked for him. By 1280, he was one of the most powerful authorities in the Mongol Empire, and he had an iron grip on his Khanate. And the Khanates, like, the Mongol Empire was divided into these different Khanates or sections of power.
Is Kublai Khan the same as Kublai Khan by the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem?
It's referenced, yeah.
I love the idea of a stately pleasure dome decree. Yeah, exactly.
The sunless sea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Xanadu, did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree where Alf, I love the idea of a river named Alf, because I can't not think of, you know, the puppet cat-eating alien Alf. Yeah, where Alf, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to men. Very, very beautiful poem by Coleridge there. But we digress. We pulled some pretty good background on the Mongol Empire from ancientorigins.net. It was quite the fragmented empire, and the title of Great Khan was given to Kublai Khan. It makes me think of, you know, the Dothraki in Game of Thrones. Clearly, the whole idea of the Khals was very much pulled from the Khans, you know?
Oh, yeah,
They were horse lords and all of that stuff.
Well, the Song of Ice and Fire, the book series on which Game of Thrones is based, is at times a beat-for-beat reimagining of the War of the Roses. So a lot of the appeal of George R.R. Martin's work comes from the fact that it's so closely based on real-life events, you know? I'm just saying he never said, no way, I made that up. Call is, you know, that's a George thing. He's acknowledges.
Does that take away the creativity of it for you? Or,
absolutely
or,
not.
No, I don't think so either.
No, yeah. I think it strengthens the narrative.
Agreed. So yeah, we've got Kublai Khan, who is the Great Khan, but unfortunately, that was more or less a ceremonial title because he wasn't particularly successful. This was a time of a very petty and fruitless war against these warring clans. A lot of infighting, I guess you could call it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Think of the film The Highlander, when there can only be one. In the eyes of a lot of these rulers, there can only be one great final boss of the Mongol Empire, one great Khan, and it's very King of the Hill-esque. Everybody wants that position. Because of this situation, it's okay for these people, these rulers, to be open enemies. Kaidu clearly opposes Kublai Khan and anyone who supports him. And this is the rich, fertile, dangerous political soil into which Khatun is born. She was brought up, like her father, in that old-school nomadic way of life. She had 14 older brothers, and as she and her siblings grew up, they were taught the traditional feats of the empire, of this culture: archery, horse riding, shooting bow and arrow from the back of a horse, and of course, wrestling. Khatun was very good at all these things. And some historians even said that she was the favorite kid because she was also very smart. She was a tactician, and the rumor is that her father would bypass her 14 brothers and come up to Khatun and say, you know, okay, well, what do you think? What do you think we should do? Should we ride in on horses? That's what we usually do. We usually do the horse thing. And then she would be like, I think that's smart. Let's stick with the horse thing, Dad.
And just really, really quickly to backtrack, her great-great-grandfather, who is not going to figure as much into this, obviously, because that's generations past, Genghis Khan, he's known for kind of uniting these warring clans. Wasn't that sort of a big part of what he did? Mm-hmm. And now that has all kind of fallen by the wayside, right? And they've become fragmented again, which is interesting, because he led with such an iron fist that he was able to kind of pull a lot of these warring clans together, and now they have kind of broken apart again.
Yes, for the sense of the empire here, Genghis Khan was born in 1162 and he passed away in 1227. And Khatun was born in 1260. So this is after he has passed, but people alive still remember him as the great uniter. One important thing about Khatun, it's tempting maybe to think she was exceptional, or, you know, the word that we throw around the West is a tomboy. But we have to remember that given the nature of the society, there was some gender equality when it came to horsemanship. Women would ride horses just as well as the dudes, and everybody at least had some proficiency with a bow and arrow.
That's right. If I'm not mistaken, even back in Genghis's day, there were female warriors. It was kind of a bit of an equal playing field, at least on the battlefield, as far as gender was concerned. Isn't that right?
More so than one would see in Western Europe.
I just remember being kind of amazed by that, or surprised by that fact, because, you know, you think of Genghis Khan as being this iron-fisted, super macho kind of, you know, dictator almost, but he really did kind of see the big picture in terms of everyone has something to contribute, at least when it comes to fighting.
Right, right. He was still a real pill, as I would say in Tennessee, but he was a pill about different things. We also have another famous figure who shows up, who is a little bit closer to the story than good old Genghis, which is what they probably called him, good old Genghi. And that is, this is the dumbest way I thought of introducing this. I hope you play along with it, Noel. And that character is Marco
Polo. You can tell where I am because I'm closer to the mic. I said.
Fish out of water.
Is that, wait, what is that? What happens then? Is that when you get out of the pool and
run
around?
Yeah, that's when you try to sneak out of the pool. Yeah.
Okay. What are the actual rules of Marco Polo?
So Marco Polo.
You're blindfolded?
The pool game. Uh-huh. Well, it depends on how much you trust your playmates there. If you don't trust them, then wrap something around their head. But otherwise, they're supposed to keep their eyes closed. They're wandering around the pool, and they go, Marco. And when they say Marco, the people who are hiding from them have to say Polo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you...
Right. It's as simple as that, though.
Use that echolocation. Well, there are some other rules. There's fish out of water. If they do that, then if they catch you getting out of the water, then you're automatically Marco for the next
round. You're stoned to death, basically, right?
You had a more intense pool culture than I did. We usually just switch sides at that point.
Yeah, I grew up in a weird Mennonite cult.
Really? It sounds like you grew up in a fundamentalist sect somewhere in Kandahar, man, stoning people to death.
You know, it takes all kinds.
And Marco Polo was just the kind of guy for this story. You know, he's the famous Venetian traveler. There's a lot of stuff about him that's kind of... embellished, I would say, or exaggerated.
There's actually a Netflix series about him that I've heard good things about. Did you see it, Ben?
I did. I am, because of some of the research and fiction I do outside of the work stuff, I really enjoy studying the story of Eurasia and Central Asia and those explorations.
So pool games aside, Marco Polo actually is the main source that we... have main primary source that we have on Cthulhu, because he, in his travels, encountered her and wrote and was quite taken by her. And I believe she actually features pretty prominently into the Netflix series. But he wrote this about her, which we found on ancientorigins.net. He referred to her as, quote, so well made in all her limbs and so tall and strongly built that she might almost be taken for a giantess, and that she was so strong that there was no young man in the whole kingdom who could overcome her, but she vanquishes them all.
We'd like to give you a sense of just how badass Cthulhu actually is. Here's another quotation from Marco Polo describing her preferred method of combat. Nothing scared her. Not only did Cthulhu ride by her father's side into battle, she'd regularly charge headfirst into enemy lines to make a dash at the host of the enemy and seize some man there out, as deftly as a hawk pounces on a bird, and carry him to her father. This is interesting because it almost sounds like some kind of brutal, bloodthirsty game of fetch. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that she was a dog or trained or anything, but that's interesting that she would just run in, snatch someone off a horse, and then take him back to dad. How strong do you have to be to do that?
Quite.
Right?
I would say. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's definitely, I mean, she was a force to be reckoned with for sure.
But there was one battle that she was very against, and that was one of the oldest battles of the human species, romance.
Exactly.
Love,
right.
And marriage.
Oh, I know. I loved Married with Children.
Yeah.
What do you think about Married with Children, Ben? Did you enjoy that?
It made me uncomfortable as a child.
It did too. It did me
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, I was afraid I was afraid that if I watched too much of it, it would like affect my real life and I might end up like
Al
or Bud
working at a shoe store.
Well, there's nothing wrong with working at a shoe store.
No, but it was specifically, he was very entranced by women's feet. There was a lot of weird fetishism in that show, if I'm not mistaken.
I think I was watching it too young an age to really understand.
It was pretty raunchy.
Like, he had to look at a particular magazine before he got amorous with his wife,
that's
Peggy.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was probably
who I always thought was really hot.
She's a smoke show.
I
yeah,
really,
no doubt
really,
about it.
I thought,
no doubt about it.
What's that actor's name who also does the voice of the character on Futurama with the one eye, Leela? Katie Seagal, yes, huge, huge crush on Peggy Bundy, more so even than Kelly, Christine Applegate.
Yeah, but they were all good actors.
They were all good
actors. What happened to the guy who played Bud?
Not a whole lot.
He's just...
What was his name? David Faustino.
Yeah, that's right. Wow. You like the show more than I, my friend.
I did quite enjoy the show. But no, Kuchun did not... like Married with Children, because it did not exist at
the time.
She
didn't like marriage as an institution.
She didn't like marriage as an institution. So she was trying to set herself up for failure, essentially, right? She rigged the game. She had that same code that I claimed to have had for so long, that she would only marry the man who could best her in wrestling, which she was known to be an expert at. And also, how emasculating must that have been at the time, right?
Well, how difficult and unfair to women were the marriages of the time?
Oh, no question about it. But what I'm saying is, what man would be willing to, like, submit himself to that kind of humiliation, maybe? You know? Because he's, like, if he wins, then he looks like a big jerk who's, like, quote-unquote beating up a girl, right?
Yeah.
And if he loses, then he's been defeated by a woman, you know, and that would probably not sit well with his reputation.
Well, keep in mind too that the idea of marriage for romantic purpose is a relatively recent notion in our species and civilization. Many of these dudes doubtlessly were not particularly attracted to Kuchun, you know, they, as the rom-coms say, they didn't love her for her. Marriages were these diplomatic deals, like any other geopolitical arrangement. The fathers chose the husband based on how it would unite or divide a tribe, how it would help the balance of power. And the woman in the marriage has just the one husband. Here's why it stinks to be a woman in these marriages, because the men on the other side of the marriage bed have as many wives as they want, and they also have a harem of women they sleep with that they don't marry. So they have like this Pokemon, gotta collect them all approach, right? So they can have their cake and eat it too, which is just cartoonishly unfair to the women.
I completely agree with you there, Ben. So what's the point? Right? What's the point of marriage as an institution? Not only did she not want to be, you know, the chattel of a man, I think probably part of her saw that inequality and saw that disconnect and was like, I don't want any part of that. I should have the same choice as any man. I should be able to stand on my own two feet. I can best a man in wrestling. I can fight alongside men on horseback, shooting my bows and arrows. Why should I allow myself to be the chattel of some dumb man?
Right. So Kaidu says, you're a woman now, girl. Boom, 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 boom.
You are really singing your heart out today, Ben.
Oh, is this working? Is
it's
this a good sound for us?
Absolutely working.
Okay. Well, you know, just we can't, because apparently we can't play the actual songs in their entirety, but that would make the episode too long too. So yes, Kaidu says, you are coming of age. I need to marry you off, Kuchun. And she says, look, I know we're both very into our culture, our nomadic lifestyle, and I get that you feel this is the right moment in my life to get married and that this will help our clan's greater aims, but I don't really want to do it, so I will get married on one condition.
Right. I think you can guess what it is. You know, we've been talking about this whole time. The condition that she be bested by said man, said suitor, in combat, hand-to-hand wrestling.
Right. So if any man wins, then she becomes his wife. But what happens if the man loses? He doesn't get killed.
Stoned to death?
No, no. You're very pro stoning to death, man. Have you ever seen it happen? It's not pretty.
Just in Marco Polo games.
Right. It wasn't that bad, but it was a tremendous financial blow. If they were defeated in wrestling, they would have to give Khatun 100 horses.
Is that like the name of their currency or?
Like physical horses, yeah.
What?
100 actual horses, yeah. No word on the quality of the horses, if they had to be stallions or if it was okay for them to be foals, whatever.
What if you had, like, I'm sure she wouldn't accept like some sickly horses.
I don't know. That's the thing about 100 horses at once. You can kind of thread them in if you're unethical. The same way that people like will use a roll of $20 bills, but the inside is just $1 bills.
Oof. Ben, you've done this before, haven't you?
I have not. No. I'm a straight shooter in the criminal underworld.
When it comes to horse trading, at least.
Yeah, when it comes to horse trading, which might be legal in Georgia, or not horse trading, but horse racing and betting might be legal in Georgia soon.
Is that true?
Yeah, that has nothing to do with anything
no,
except
it doesn't.
Horses.
And isn't it kind of an inherently a little bit of a...
It's very
cruel,
problematic.
Problematic yeah. enterprise, yeah.
So back to the historical horses. Let's hop on our historical horses here. Khatun has a lot of people come try to wrestle her, right?
Of course she does, which goes completely against what I thought would happen. Because, again, I would think who would want to submit themselves to this? But I guess they were less concerned about being beaten, and they were pretty sure that they would reign supreme. It's almost like a reverse kind of glass slipper situation, right?
Absolutely. And this adds up pretty quickly. Khatun reportedly gains over 10,000 horses from these wrestling matches. If you do the math, 100 per loss to 10,000, that means she wrestled and beat more than 100 dudes.
That's legendary, man.
That's crazy.
Wow.
There are professional wrestlers who haven't beat more than 100 people.
That's true. I don't know that there are more than 100 professional wrestlers in the WWE canon.
Surely.
You think so?
Oh, God. Have you looked up their wiki in the 80s? They had some...
Well, I mean, at one time.
Oh, at one time. Yeah, I don't know. I think overall, yes, but
yes,
I don't know
I
all
agree.
At one time.
Canon was the wrong word. We discussed that in the last episode. I'm clearly a little foggy on what canon means. There's a fantastic line that really sets the tone for all this. So let's you know, she gained 10,000 horses, defeated more than 100 suitors in a book called She Caused a Riot about Khatun. Hannah Jewell described the scene as such. The Mongolian steppes, as in the geographical steppes, were littered with the debris of shattered male egos. I like that imagery. You can't not root for Khatun in this whole situation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys were cocky. They came along thinking they were just going to walk away with the keys to the kingdom, a.k.a. Khatun's hand in marriage. Let's not forget, she's a princess. This is a big deal to be her suitor. You would, you know, be in line for the throne or, you know, a very high position of power. One particularly cocky suitor upped the ante significantly and bet 1,000 horses on one of these wrestling matches. And, you know, Khatun's parents supposedly liked the guy and were really hoping that they'd work out. So they actually asked Khatun to, please, darling daughter, throw the match. I can't believe, I mean, again, this also kind of speaks to the relative progressiveness of this culture, right? Like, you know, they're allowing this to go down. They're not just saying, no, you got to marry whoever we say. They have agreed to her, caveats here, right?
I mean, maybe she was a bruiser with her parents, too. This is the thing, right? She listens. Picture her with her hands steepled, maybe a little, or her fingers steepled, rather, maybe Monty Burns style, going, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As their parents are telling her all this stuff. And then she goes, okay, I've listened to your advice. I've taken your counsel. So she goes into the ring. And then, as Marco Polo says, she throws him right valiantly on the palace pavement, takes the 1,000 horses. And Kaidu here is a little conflicted because he's like, she's supposed to get married. But also, horses are money. And we are rolling in the horse poop today, like in a good way. We have this wealth. We have this status. People respect us. And eventually, It got to the point where he just started saying, you know what? Her 14 brothers are okay, but my daughter, Khatun, deserves to be the next Khan more than any dude in Mongolia. He didn't say dude, he said man.
Of course. And, you know, besides, I mean, I think there's plenty of obvious reasons why Khatun would not have wanted to be tied down to a man. We talk about that culture of the concubine and the harem situation and the fact that women who were married were, at that point, sort of sub-citizens, right? They were really just the property of their husbands. She wanted better than that for herself. I think that's clear just from the way she carried herself and, you know, how important that warrior lifestyle was to her. So it's entirely possible that that was the main reason why she didn't want to marry. There's also some speculation that she could have been gay, and that was something that was not acceptable and that she would not have been able to openly discuss. So she, you know, created this whole situation with the wrestling so that she would never have to be married. But my money is on just her being a strong-willed, individualistic human person who did not want to give all of that up. Because, of course, with marriage comes, you know, babies and pregnancy, and a pregnant woman isn't going to be able to, you know, leap into battle, right? That's not something that will be on the table. And then she'll be fussed over, and she didn't want to be fussed over. She wanted to be completely independent.
So there are a couple of rumors here. Now we're leaving the sunny, well-lit land of historical fact, and we're entering the overcast region of historical speculation. There are differing accounts of why Khatun was not into the idea of marriage, and some of them involve the idea of romantic relationships with family members. One rumor says that she was in love with one of her first cousins and she was unable to marry this individual. The thing about that is, you know, a romantic relationship with a first cousin at that time throughout the world would not be particularly unusual. So there would have been some other intervening reason. You can read more about that one on historycollection.co. There's also, this is like the Mongol Empire version of TMZ. Level news, please treat it as such. We found this article on allthat'sinteresting.com that says she decided to get married because rumors were spreading that she was having an incestuous affair with her own father and that she chose to marry a man without wrestling him because she wanted to save her father's reputation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's where, you know, the duty and honor and obligation stuff kicks into high gear. Another historian, Rashad al-Din, says that it's a little bit more of a happy ending, that she did actually finally fall in romantic love and married a ruler in the Mongol Empire based in Persia named Gajan. I don't know, man. The last one we heard was that she married a prisoner who tried and failed to kill her father.
I mean, I guess she maybe would have respected the audacity, you know, and the pluckiness of it all, right? She seems like has a very interesting code.
That just makes the wedding dinner so weird.
Really awkward. Really awkward. Tried and failed.
Like you pass, you pass the plate of horse meat or whatever to your father-in-law, and he's like, "Did you poison it?" And you go, "Ah,
yeah!" That's funny, Ben.
He's busting my chops.
Oh, busting your horse chops! But again, she's such a unique person with such a individualistic perspective. I could see how she would respect somebody who would have the audacity to go after her father.
She has scruples aplenty, and not the currency.
Exactly.
We do know that eventually she did get married. She did take a husband, but she was never defeated as a wrestler. And that was universally acknowledged throughout the land. When Khatun is in her early 40s, her father is ailing. Kaidu is dying. He is surrounded by his children, his multiple wives. On his literal deathbed, he says, "I regret never appointing Khatun as the leader of our clan. She's not just the strongest, but she's also very well respected by the soldiers. She is by far and away, streets ahead, the best leader we could have had, and that's on me."
Why didn't he do it then? He could have done it. Couldn't he have like done that with his dying breath? Appointed her Khan?
Well, it would have been breaking Mongolian traditions to name her Khan.
Oh, I see.
To have a female Khan. And everybody is aware of his personal beliefs, but they're also aware of the traditional stuff. At this point, you know, she's 41 years old. She's got years of experience. People in the army really respect her, and they're also kind of terrified of her because, again, she can ride a horse into battle, literally snatch someone off the horse, just like a hawk picking up a little rodent, and then bring it back wherever she pleases. She is a BA, but despite her father's wishes, she's not allowed to be a Khan because her 14 brothers that we mentioned put a lot of pressure on her dad.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot about the 14 brothers. They wouldn't have had that.
This feels like a real-life fairy tale. There's a weird test to marry the princess. There's an egregious number of siblings.
That's right. That's right. And so there's even some speculation that her brothers had planned to have her killed because the rules of the who ascends to be the great Khan do not revolve entirely around gender or around lineage, age, rather. They're specifically about who's the strongest. So they knew that she was the strongest, and they were worried that she would overtake them. And therefore, supposedly, you know, hatch some kind of plot to have her killed. But that's not really proven. It's just something that we've seen floating around here and there.
Oh, yeah, the idea that maybe they had her killed or poisoned.
Correct. And a lot of this is attributed to the fact that when Kublai Khan took over control of the empire, he actually used a lot of the stories of Khatun as propaganda. So they were much exaggerated and kind of twisted to serve his purposes. And it wasn't until we started seeing those Marco Polo accounts come up that people really started to hear the truth about Khatun's story.
And you might say, What a neat, fascinating story. Thanks so much, Ben Nolan Casey, for cluing me in. But we have one last twist for you. This might surprise some people. It might be a well-known fact to some of our fellow listeners already. But the story of Khatun may be a family story that is personal to you, and you didn't know it because, you see, Khatun was far from being the only descendant of Genghis Khan. In fact, Y chromosome data and research that came out a number of years ago, I think, proves that about 0.5% of the male population of the world is somehow descended from Genghis Khan.
Ooh, that means Genghis was a busy boy.
I mean, you know, it's interesting, though, when you think of it, like even for the three of us in this room, this might be a family story for one of us.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, not you, because we know your DNA.
That's right.
You're Scandinavian.
I'm pretty exclusively Scandinavian. Yeah, that's right.
Which is pretty cool, right?
Yeah, no, it's fine. You know, yeah, it's fine.
You got these sparkly eyes.
Yeah, sparkly really eyes. Nice. Got my redness in my beard, you know, all that stuff. I'm cool with it. It was just a little underwhelming, I guess, you know, my Ancestry.com results.
You wanted a twist?
I wanted a twist.
You wanted like an unmarked helicopter to land in your backyard and some guy get out of the helicopter and come up and say, come with us.
You are the chosen one. Yeah, I was kind of hoping for
23andMe only exists to find
me. Exactly. He is the child.
I still have not taken any DNA tests.
I know you guys are reticent to do so. I don't know why. I don't care. I guess I just have no sense of self-preservation.
Well, people like to learn about themselves.
It's
you
true.
Know what I mean?
It's true.
Casey, did you ever take a DNA test?
I have not. No, I'm still entertaining the fantasy of my DNA not ending up in a database somewhere.
Oh, fantasy. Yeah, that's a good word.
It's
yeah.
a nice story.
So thank you so much to everyone for tuning in. Thanks, of course, to Gabe. Thanks to Christopher. I feel like we're almost on a first name basis now as an audience with these guys. Thanks, of course, to Alex, who composed our banging track.
Big time thanks to Alex. Thanks to Eves. Check out her show, This Day in History Class. Slight thanks to Jonathan Strickland, the Devious Quister. You can check him out in his human form on a show called Tech Stuff that exists out there in the world, as well as when he materializes in our studio to wreak havoc on our mental health.
I feel like we need to soap this outro before he hops in. So real quick, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter. We may or may not post a picture from this studio on our Facebook page.
Let's be honest, we're not going to.
I might.
Okay.
If you're cool with it.
I'm cool with it.
Are you cool with it, Casey?
Fine.
All right. Wow. Okay. That was a real cold fine. All right. Well, we're going to do it anyway. Forward to the future. Find us on Ridiculous Historians. You can also find us as individuals on the social medias.
Yeah, you can find me exclusively on Instagram. I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram. Stay tuned. I'm going to do some weird, crazy things. And I am at Ben Bolin on Twitter, where you can see my overwhelmingly positive opinion of people's pets.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.